During World War II and the rise of fascism, and actually even the years preceding World War II, a remarkable thing happened that involved 1,000 musicians and the future of music in Europe and in Israel, for that matter. It's a phenomenon we'll call the Orchestra of Exiles, and I'm Norman Gilliland. My guest for University of the Air is Frank Turkheimer.
Good morning.
And Frank is an attorney, but also the co-author, as you may recall from an earlier conversation in University of the Air, of Forgotten Trials of the Holocaust, a related topic, but this will take us much farther into the world of music, which, like so many other spheres, was in a great state of turmoil after 1933 when Hitler came to power in Germany. And what got you intrigued by this topic first? Frank, how did you discover this Orchestra of Exiles?
Well, the subject of music is always, it's always been a thing I've been very interested in since childhood. And I think there was a program on public television called Orchestra of Exiles, which I watched. And that kind of combined with some reading that I had done mainly before and after, just kind of got me into this in a little more detail. Specifically, the readings would be biographies of conductors, Arturo Toscanini and Wilhelm Furtwängler, in specifics. It sort of meshes with this.
And before we get into those personalities, and they were forceful personalities, not just in music, but as it turned out, in politics.
Right.
What was the European stage like in 1933? I mean, whatever happened in Germany, of course, was going to have spillover, was going to have repercussions in the rest of Europe.
Well, you know, Norman, it's interesting you say that, because that's with the benefit of hindsight. And that's why the central focus of our talk, this man, Bronislaw Huberman, was so brilliant because of his insights, because, in fact, he saw that what was happening in Germany in 1933 would indeed impact on all of Europe, contrary to what many others believed, who thought Hitler was a passing fad and things will get back to normal after a while. What happened in Germany after Hitler came to power in January of 1933 was what we would call the Aryanization of German culture. And this affected the music world in particular, because a very high percentage of the musicians in Germany at the time were Jewish. I mean, I think the Jews constituted 1% of the German population. There were about 600,000 Jews out of 60 million Germans. And the percentage of Jews in orchestras was probably 25, 30, 35%. So this constituted a radical redistribution of musicians once Hitler came to power. And the question initially was, as I suggested, would this was it temporary, or was it going to have more serious consequences?
And we don't see a lot of, I think, emigration from Germany until about, 1938?
Yeah, well, the central character in this story about an orchestra of exiles is this a man by the name of Bronislaw Huberman. He was born in 1882, in what is technically, he's Polish, but as you know, Poland was dismembered by the Prussian, Russian, and Austrian empires in the 1790s, so there is no Poland on any map of 19th century Europe. But for all practical purposes, he was Polish, although technically born in South Prussia, or part of Germany. And he showed extraordinary abilities with the violin as a child. And his parents were not terribly wealthy, but they sunk some money into his education and at some point sent him to Berlin to study under probably the foremost European violinist of that period, Joseph Joachim.
Very, very famous throughout Europe and very influential. A lot of major works by major composers written.
Right, a good friend of all the major.
Brahms in particular.
Exactly. And then there's a parallel here, which will become evident in a few minutes. Joachim made his debut, so to speak, on the European stage in the early part of the 19th century when he played the Beethoven Violin Concerto as a child with an orchestra that was conducted by Felix Mendelssohn. And so it was. There's a certain fittingness here that when Huberman made his debut, as you point out, in I think late 1895, when he was still 13 years old, he played the Brahms Violin Concerto before a crowd that included none other than Johannes Brahms. I think it was 3-4 months before Brahms died. And Brahms, who was no fan of child prodigies, was blown away by Huberman's performance as a 13-year-old.
These links always fascinate me, Frank, because on the one hand, you have Joachim, who is linked all the way back to Mendelssohn. And then on the other hand, he is linked as the teacher to the young Bronislaw Huberman, who takes us all the way into the 1940s. So between them, this vast span of
right,
music that
and
they cover.
As I'm going to try to do before we finish our discussion is I'm going to try to take it into the 21st century. So Huberman obviously is portended a brilliant career as a violinist, and indeed it was, and he was recognized as one of the foremost violinists in Europe, in the world at the time. At some point during... Before he was about 50, he visited Palestine, and he saw there was a fledgling Jewish community there, which we'll get back to in a minute.
It's a British protectorate at that
time? It was a British mandate at the time. I think it was called the Mandate. That was after World War I when the Ottoman Empire was broken up, and Syria and Lebanon were French mandates, and Iraq, Jordan, and Palestine, British. We come to Hitler coming to power in 1933, and this is what I call the Aryanization of Jewish music in Germany. And the reactions to that were mixed, and it probably typified the reactions of the Jews in Germany in general. Some said this is going to be a passing fad, it's not going to last, and they formed Jewish orchestras, which went through Germany and played before Jewish audiences. And that was perfectly okay with the regime at that time in 1933-34. Huberman was of the complete opposite view. And I've got to say, it's one of the more brilliant insights that any human being could have had in the early 1930s.
It's the difference isn't between short-term and long-term thinking.
Yeah, because he not only did he think that these people were foolish, that German Jews were at great risk, but he saw Hitler as a threat to all of Europe and therefore to European Jewry. And you've got to realize this is like 5 years later. Churchill is Chamberlain is coming home and talking about peace in our time and after Munich in 1938. So Huberman violently disagreed with this notion that Jewish musicians had any future in Europe. And he felt that the only way you could preserve the culture that the Jews were contributing to Europe was to get out. And the only place he thought they could go would be to Palestine. And so starting very soon after Hitler came to power, he began to organize to try to get an orchestra, what we would call an orchestra of exiles, to go to Palestine. This required three things. It required musicians. It required money, because you obviously can't just send the musicians. You have to send their families, too, because
hundreds of people we're talking about already.
Altogether, we're talking about 1,000 people. I mean, there's no... And you need entry permits for Palestine. You just couldn't go to Palestine. You had to get the approval of both the British and the Jewish agency. And those entry permits were few and difficult to get. So money was relatively simple for Huberman. I mean, it was a matter of having benefit concerts. He would give concerts, and the proceeds would go to his effort to finance the transportation of ultimately about 1,000 people, musicians and their families.
He had to move very quickly, though, didn't he? Because, I mean, it's one thing to set up a concert, a benefit concert, but then in this, what turns out to be a very short period of time of just 3, 4, 5 years, he has to make all this happen for all these people.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, it's less than 4 years. I mean, Hitler came to power in January of 1933, and the Palestine Symphony Orchestra, as we'll get to in a few minutes, had its inaugural program in December of 1936. So he had to move fast. The concerts, you know, he auditioned and he was tried to be fair because he knew that this was a matter of life and death, that musicians who were not chosen might well end up dying. So if he was listening to someone whom he knew, he would be told in advance and he would listen with his back turned to the musician so that he was completely fair in the selection process. And he slowly started to put together an orchestra.
But he did have then, you're saying, he did obviously have to exclude certain people in this audition process.
And, absolutely.
Knowing that if he did so, that might be a matter of life and death for
them. Yes, that's the sad reality that
he faced. It's not just an audition.
That's the sad reality that he faced, and it was very difficult for him. I mean, he didn't do that lightly, but he, in his fundraising efforts, he said this is not to transport all Jewish musicians from Europe to Palestine. It's to create an orchestra. That was, and he couldn't really go back on that. Sometime in early 1936, he was in New York City, and he approached Arturo Toscanini. Arturo Toscanini's a long time ago, but he was clearly, perhaps with Wilhelm Furtwängler, one of the two outstanding conductors of that time. Toscanini, I think, made his debut at age 19
in 1887,
when he was touring with an Italian opera company in Brazil.
That's right.
The conductor couldn't do it, and he took over at age 19.
He was a cellist.
And he's another link. I mean, he knew Verdi. He performed the first performance of Otello. Yeah. He was the cellist in the orchestra. So by the 1930s, he was clearly recognized as one of the two most outstanding conductors, the other being Wilhelm Furtwängler, the conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic. And that's an interesting story, too. When Hitler wanted to, Aryanize orchestras, Furtwängler fought him. He tried to keep the Jews on the Berlin Philharmonic playing there.
Furtwängler being non-Jewish.
He's not Jewish, yeah. Was not Jewish. And I think he had a personal assistant who basically kept his life in order, who was also Jewish. But ultimately, of course, he failed. And he continued to conduct the Berlin Philharmonic, for which he has received much criticism in the post-war period. Furtwängler is an interesting man. He opposed Hitler as much as he could, but he still played. He played for him, and I think his biography is called The Devil's Concertmaster or something like that. But to give you an idea of what he would do if he'd come up onto the stage and Hitler was in the audience. At some point, everybody gets up and does a Heil Hitler thing with the right arm stretched forward at a 45-degree angle. And Furtwängler, to keep from doing this, would hold his baton in his right hand, thereby sort of immobilizing his right arm so he didn't have to participate in an exercise that he thought was awful. But he continued to perform, and interestingly, in the post-war period, there was a denazification program, which he basically passed, and he was offered a position to conduct the Chicago Symphony. And he actually got the offer, and the protests were humongous, and he had to turn it down.
Because the details of his resistance weren't well known.
And he did continue to conduct. I mean, he didn't have to. I mean, Toscanini, you know, is the other example, of course. Once Mussolini came to power, and Hitler and Toscanini appreciated what fascism really was, he wouldn't go back to Italy.
Yeah, he was palpably anti-fascist, Toscanini was. Actually got beat up a time or two.
Toscanini was the first non-German invited to conduct at the Bayreuth Festival, the Wagner Festival. And he did that, I think, in 1930 or 31. And then after Hitler came to power, he was invited again. And Wagner's daughter wrote to him. And even Hitler wrote him a letter pleading that he come. He wouldn't go. And it went even further. He did conduct in Salzburg, which is in Austria, before the Anschluss in 1938. And Bayreuth and Salzburg had a deal where they would send each other's concerts by radio across the border. Well, when Bruno Walter, whom I should mention in another instance, who's also Jewish, a German-Jewish
very prominent, conductor, rising conductor
yes,
of the time.
Yeah. When he conducted in Salzburg, the Germans refused to broadcast it. And at that point, Toscanini said, I'm not going to Salzburg either. And Walter, ultimately, he's also one of our orchestra members in exile. He was slated to conduct the Berlin Philharmonic, and the Berlin Philharmonic was pressured to cancel the concert if he was to conduct, so he declined to conduct. And Richard Strauss took his place.
Another really interesting case, and we could certainly do hours on the finer points of Richard Strauss's accommodation, if you want to use that word, of the Nazi regime. Without being an adherent by any means, apparently, and yet, and I think even having some Jews in his family, if I remember correctly.
That's right, yeah.
And yet, being in a position where he couldn't leave, he was certainly too old at that point to leave. A very ambiguous figure, Richard Strauss, that way.
Yeah, and you have a somewhat similar ambiguity with Furt Wrangler, I think.
Really?
Yeah. But what happened was when Strauss agreed to do it and Bruno Walter said, you know, this man composed a tone poem on Heldenleben, which is a hero's life.
Right.
And Walter says, oh, quite a hero, isn't he?
He has to take my job when I have to give it up.
Yeah. So anyway, getting back to Huberman, he asked Toscanini if Toscanini would do a benefit concert so that Huberman could raise some more money to get the orchestra going. And Toscanini said, I'll do you one better. I'll come and conduct. And not only that, but he'd pay his own expenses, his wife. And back in those days, this was not a simple thing to go from New York to Tel Aviv. I mean, you take a boat across the ocean, then you fly from London to Milan and Milan to Alexandria or something. And it was not easy. And, you know, keep in mind, by that time, Toscanini was well into his 60s.
I guess.
He was
60s.
Born in 68. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's getting quite old. Well, he agreed to do it. And Huberman, by this time, had gotten together most of the orchestra. He did have a problem with the Jewish agency, believe it or not, which was headed by David Ben-Gurion, who became prime minister after Israeli independence.
So why this problem with the Jewish agency not welcoming Jews?
Ben-Gurion had the notion that these musicians were kind of, they were not the people of the soil. They were not going to be farmers. They were not going to plant things. They would find the desert environment of Palestine quite hostile, and they would go back to Europe. And thus the entry permits would be wasted. And so he refused to issue these entry permits. And now Huberman had to go over his head through Chaim Weizmann and some English nobility that was sympathetic to override Ben-Gurion to get these entry permits for the Jewish musicians and their families. As it turned out, there were only two musicians who went back. One was a young Pole who didn't go back because of the environment. He just wanted to complete his doctorate. And unfortunately,
Hard to imagine, isn't it, at this point, that you would go back for a doctorate.
Yeah. Unfortunately for him, it got stalled and he didn't get out and he was murdered in the Holocaust. And then there was a Jewish violist, a German violist, who indeed found the desert environment of Palestine just intolerable, and she went back to Germany, and she was murdered in the Holocaust. But aside from that, they all stayed.
Out of 1,000?
Out of 1,000.
Just those two went back.
That's it. So we get to 1936, and they have to be, the orchestra has to, of course, they have a program, and Toscanini is not going to rehearse with them. I mean, he's going there for the real thing. I mean, just have a cursory rehearsal. And the conductor who was doing the rehearsing was, I guess he was then known as Hans Wilhelm Steinberg.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Steinberg had been the conductor of the Frankfurt Opera, and he was Jewish. And he his career in Germany came to a very abrupt end when the stormtroopers came into a rehearsal, literally walked onto the stage, took his baton from him, and told him if he ever came back, he was a dead man.
Yeah, he was conducting a rehearsal of Ernst Toch's opera, The Fan, and I guess that too would have been politically very incorrect at the time in Nazi Germany, and the result was very abrupt. I want to get more into Wilhelm Steinberg or William Steinberg and these other leading lights of this phenomenon that we call the Orchestra of Exiles, and we'll do that right after this. You're listening to University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Frank Turkheimer, and we're looking at this phenomenon from Germany and Europe in general of the 1930s. It's called the Orchestra of Exiles, in which a remarkable Polish violinist, Bronisław Huberman, managed to help the escape of some 1,000 Jews from Central Europe, largely through founding this Orchestra of Exiles in Palestine. And this brings into play all kinds of other individuals, too, including some prominent conductors. And we mentioned Wilhelm Steinberg, who became much better known in this country as William Steinberg.
Yeah, he after his experience with the stormtroopers, he knew he better get out of there. And he went to Palestine. And once the Toscanini had agreed to conduct the opening performance, the orchestra had to be rehearsed, and obviously Toscanini was not going to do that. Steinberg was the person to do it, and he rehearsed with the orchestra, and at the same time, the concert hall was being constructed. And so you've got to imagine doing rehearsals with the noise and all that in the background, and at one point, Steinberg just snapped. He couldn't do it. And he went over to the foreman and said, how much overtime would it take to get you to do this in the evening? And the foreman spoke with some of the workers and said, we'll work at night. You don't have to pay us any overtime. We just want to have tickets to the first concert.
Yeah, what a great story.
And I think they had a special performance for the workers, ultimately. So Steinberg, and this is sort of a theme which can run through our discussion, is Germany's loss is America's gain. I mean, their cultural loss was our cultural gain. He came to the United States. His name then was not Hans Wilhelm Steinberg, but William Steinberg, and I think he conducted the Pittsburgh Symphony.
Yes, for many years.
For many, many years, about 30 years.
And apparently fairly humble, too. He was quoted as saying something like to one of the violinists or one of the musicians, I could be wrong about this, but I think I'm right. Which, as the conductors go of the time, was definitely soft.
You know, I don't understand how Steinberg could have even begun to rehearse the orchestra with that background noise. I mean, I attended a dress rehearsal of the New York Philharmonic a few years ago. I think Kurt Mazur was doing the conducting. And you've got this full orchestra with maybe 8 bass players. And at some point he stops and he turns to the second bass player and he says, are you afraid you're going to disturb someone?
Well, that's right. Yes, the conductor has to have a very specific sense of what that sound is supposed to be and be sensitive to every instrument in the orchestra.
Every instrument. And how you can do that with banging and hammering in the background. Well, I guess that's why Steinberg snapped. So Toscanini came. Now, Toscanini, when he agreed to do this, he got the following letter, and I'm going to take the liberty of extending this Orchestra in Exiles theme to scientists in exile, This scientist wrote to Toscanini after Toscanini said he would conduct the Palestine Symphony. After noting his, and I use his words, unmatched preeminence as interpreter of the world's musical literature, he wrote, "In the fight against Hitler and fascist criminals, you have shown yourself to be a man of great dignity. I feel deeply thankful because you have given the soon-to-be-founded Palestine Orchestra a gentle push forward of inestimable significance. With great love and respect, cordially, Albert Einstein."
Bit of a musician himself.
Yeah, violin. Yeah.
Amateur violinist.
Yeah. Actually, if you want, you can. The story I love with Einstein as a violinist, he played in string quartets.
Yes.
And I think the way this works with string quartets is you kind of scrimmage around to decide who's going to be the first violinist and the second violinist. And he was a very good friend of a scientist in Holland, a man by the name of Lorentz, who was actually significant in developing the relativity theory. And he would sometimes stop in the court in Holland and play with the Queen of Holland, who was a violinist. And obviously, anybody else, you play with the Queen, she is the first violinist.
But, long tradition of that.
But Einstein didn't see it. Mm-hmm. And they did their usual scrimmaging, and when it was clear that he was the better player, he was the first violinist in the string quartet, and the Queen was second. Anyway, that's our little divergence into scientists in exile.
But our gain, again, as you again, say, Frank, yeah, all of these prominent conductors, let alone musicians, coming to this country in the 30s, including William Steinberg, who not only conducted but recorded prominently with the Pittsburgh Symphony for many
Bruno
years.
Walter, Eric Leinsdorf.
Bruno Walter, New York Philharmonic.
And Leinsdorf succeeded Koussevitzky with the Boston Symphony. So Toscanini arrives in Tel Aviv, and he's going to have one or two brief rehearsals with the orchestra. And the main piece in their opening performance was the Brahms Symphony No. 2. And this is just so typical Toscanini. I mean, instead of saying, "Hello, how are you? Nice to be here," he gets up there and she says, "Brahms." And they start to go through the Brahms Symphony No. 2. And Toscanini had a very well-deserved reputation for being both a perfectionist and volatile.
Yes, that's right.
And they go through it's a long first movement, not a sound out of Toscanini. They go through the second movement, not a sound out of Toscanini. And when the musicians were interviewed afterwards, that almost to a person, they thought, "Are we so bad that we're not even worthy of his corrections?" Well, that all came to an end sometime in the third movement when he exploded with something in Italian that nobody understood. And you had chaos there until finally they figured out what he meant and what they had to change. And these concerts, then he had gave a series of concerts in Palestine and in Tel Aviv, maybe in Haifa. And they also toured. And they toured and they went to Cairo and Alexandria and performed to sellout crowds there as well. It was a really big thing in the music world that Arturo Toscanini was conducting in Asia and in Africa, which is basically, you know, where he was. And
sure.
It was, of course, a big boost for the Palestine Symphony Orchestra. Huberman, as I've tried to indicate, was a man of great vision. And he imposed a condition upon his musicians that when they came to Palestine, they were not just to perform in the orchestra, but they were to teach the children, teach music. And everyone was required at no charge to give music instruction to young children in Palestine to try to perpetuate this tradition, which Huberman saw as being decimated in Europe. And that's what they did. And I have no doubt that in today's Israel Philharmonic, there are the grandchildren of some of those who were taught in the 1930s by Huberman's exiles, so that you have this continuity.
In Europe, of course, you know, it's dangerous enough, but it's not as if coming to Palestine, to the Middle East, would be a bed of roses either, because, of course, it becomes increasingly contentious there as the Palestinians versus the influx of more and more Jews, and how did the orchestra and the personalities involved with it contend with that?
Well, it was, they were, the, as more and more Jews came to Palestine in the 30s, Arab opposition to Jewish immigration increased, and there were acts of violence against the Jews, and I'm sure there were retaliatory violence as well. It wasn't a one-sided thing, but it became an increasingly hostile place and violent place, and which, unfortunately, this is now 1936, 37. Unfortunately, if you pick up today's newspaper, it's still going on. And this affected Toscanini because he agreed to come back 2 years later, and he was told not to. He said, it's just not safe. But it's not Toscanini's style to...
No. He had faced danger before.
Yeah. Yeah, so he went, and actually he wandered off at some point. People were worried about him, but he was obviously okay. And they had another round of performances in 1938 under far more security than had been the case in 1936. Interestingly, one of the pieces Toscanini performed in 38 was a piece by Wagner.
Oh, really?
And I don't know if you remember, but I don't know, about 10, 15 years ago, the Israel Philharmonic had scheduled a Wagner piece.
For the first time in how many years? Or actually, first time ever, I would think.
Well, it's not ever.
Since the Toscanini.
Since the Toscanini. And because Wagner was an open and notorious anti-Semite. And I think what happened was the first time it was scheduled by the Israel Philharmonic, it was canceled. But then ultimately, I think they finally did play.
They did. Yeah.
They did play a Wagner piece. Well, Toscanini, in the second round, he played Wagner. And let me tell you, there wasn't one peep of opposition. I mean, if Toscanini says we're playing Wagner, we're playing Wagner. And when he was asked about it, he said his music is great.
And that is a dilemma that occasionally comes up in, I suppose, any kind of music, but classical music in particular, where the pieces, of course, are extended and tend to have histories. How do you separate the individual from the music? And in fact, do you even have to do that? I mean, if you look into the histories of any number of composers, you would find they're not nice people, but their music is great. And that's just a separation that you have to make if you're going to perform it.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't. Beethoven wasn't the most wonderful person to his nephew.
That's right.
You know, and he's kind of sort of abused him. I mean, I think.
Yeah, he was hard on him. That's right. Nephew attempted suicide and all of that, and on it goes. I mean, in terms of their personal lives, in terms of their political lives.
Right. So, but as far as Toscanini was concerned, it was the music that mattered. He wasn't going to be influenced by it, and he was of such stature. There wasn't a peep in opposition. And so the Palestine Symphony played Wagner decades before the Israel Philharmonic finally got around to doing it.
Well, I mean, it is, I think, a kind of a triumph, isn't it, to be able to do that, to say that we can rise above this, that we're strong enough, that we can play music by somebody who would disapprove of our very presence here.
I think that's right. I think it's almost... showing up that person, showing we're bigger than you are.
Right.
You know, exactly.
You mentioned that you're 1936, and of course a major part of this conversation has to do with Bronislaw Huberman, and he was still concertizing, I guess, worldwide in the process of gathering this orchestra and establishing it in Palestine.
Yes, he was, and it took an enormous toll on him. I mean, he kept on traveling, and his family life was not ideal. I think he married and had a child, and he was divorced. And I think the wife's second husband actually adopted the son that Huberman had. So if you look at that facet of his life, it was obviously not very successful. But there was one other. Rather unfortunate thing that happened to him. In 1936, he was performing in Carnegie Hall. He had this double violin case, and he had a Gibson Stradivarius, which was on one side, and a Guarnerius on the other. And for some reason, he arbitrarily chose to play with Guarnerius at that concert in 1936. And it was well known that he had a double violin case, so that obviously if he's playing with one
violin, the other one's in there.
I don't even know if I'd call him a third-rate musician, but a musician who had gigs here and there, and I think may have played with the Washington Symphony Orchestra, National Orchestra for a while, by the name of Julius Altman, had a mediocre career, and he put two and two together and figured if he's playing with one, the other one is in his locker room, in his dressing room. And he lied his way, and he got past the guard and got into Huberman's dressing room, and there was the Strad, the Gibson Strad, which he then took and put all kinds of goop on it to conceal it. It kept its tone, and he thought that might elevate his career if he was playing with this wonderful Strad. Unlike an earlier theft of the Strad, where it was returned a day or two later, this one was gone as far as Huberman was concerned. And Altman used it for many, many years.
Could never tell anybody what it was.
Never told anybody what it was until his deathbed in 65 maybe, something like that, about 30 years later on. He's dying, and he tells his second wife about a note, look at the violin or something, there was a little note in there indicating what it was. And then he died, and she gave it to Lloyd, returned it to Lloyds of London, who had insured it and given Huberman $30,000 back in 1936 for the Strad.
$30,000.
That's right.
Price has gone up a little since then, even adjusted for inflation.
Very much so. And she returned it to Lloyd's and got a fairly sizable reward, $250,000, something like that, which she squandered. And Lloyd's sold it to another violinist. And years later, this other violinist, whose name I don't remember.
We'll get to it.
I'm sure you can find.
You're thinking of Joshua Bell.
No.
Oh, sorry.
No. Lloyd sold it to another violinist who had at some point indicated he was going to donate it to a place in Germany. And Joshua Bell found out about that, and it just rankled him, the idea that after Huberman had basically devoted his life to getting Jewish musicians out of Germany, and in fact out of Central Europe, that his violin would end up in Germany was really anathema to him. So Bell sold his own Strad for a couple of million dollars, put together another $2 million, and bought that Stradivarius, which he then renamed the Gibson Huberman Stradivarius. And as I think we mentioned earlier, Huberman died a fairly young man, died in 1947 when he was 65. But Bell now has a Stradivarius, and in a sense, it came home in 2003 when Bell performed with the Israel Philharmonic. And of course, he performed with the Gibson Huberman Stradivarius, so that in that sense, that violin finally came home. And if we kind of want to look upon our brief conversation this morning, I mean, we can go back to Joachim playing the Beethoven Violin Concerto with Mendelssohn conducting in the early 19th century to the early 21st century, with Bell playing with Huberman's violin and with the Israel Philharmonic. And the centerpiece, of course, of all this is the 65-year lifespan of Branislav Huberman.
We're going to look further at this phenomenon of an orchestra of exiles when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Frank Turkheimer. We've been looking at this Orchestra of Exiles, a remarkable phenomenon. Some 1,000 Jewish musicians brought out of Nazi Germany during the 1930s to form an orchestra in Palestine, and brought essentially by one person who spearheaded this whole effort. His name, Bronislaw Huberman. He was a Polish-born violin virtuoso. And in the case of Huberman, unfortunately, he lives only until 1947. But in the case of a lot of these musicians, not the ones brought to Palestine, but some of those who, for one reason or another, stayed in Germany and stayed in Nazi-occupied territory and continued to perform during the war, there was a big question, wasn't there, Frank, of how to rehabilitate their reputations and even to sort out how culpable they were.
Absolutely. And it was a very difficult matter, and there were just too many shades of gray. I mean, Fort Wrangler was a perfect example. I mean, you could make a case for saying, well, wait a minute, he continued to play for Hitler. He had his deal with Goebbels, the propaganda minister, and he basically performed for Hitler. And why should we tolerate somebody like this in the post-war period? Therefore, when the Chicago Symphony offers him the podium, of course it should be boycotted. On the other hand, he was not an evil man. He did his best to save Jews as long as he could. And as I mentioned earlier, he had this kind of pro forma way of avoiding participating in the Heil Hitler routine. And I hadn't mentioned it before, but the general consensus in the United States was, we don't want this man here. He is, as that book that I mentioned describes it, he was the devil's concertmaster. And interestingly enough, he had a major, major defender, the violinist Yehudi Menuhin, who of course was Jewish. And Menuhin saw the good side of Fort Wrangler and felt that he was getting a raw deal. And he continued to perform with him in the post-war period. And to that limited extent, Fort Wrangler was somewhat rehabilitated by Menuhin's presence.
Did Fort Wrangler then continue to conduct where? In Germany?
In Germany, yeah. He conducted in Germany. I think, everybody gets old, including Arturo Toscanini. but I think they both conducted into the 50s. Fort Wrangler was younger than Toscanini.
Yeah, Toscanini conducted, yes, I think his last recordings are 1954.
Something like that, yeah.
With
the NBC Orchestra. And then I think he was well, if he was born in 67, he was well in his 80s, I guess.
Yeah, oh 85, yes.
85
yes.
years old, and he was still conducting. So that was, Toscanini, as we've talked about, was very, very adamant, very strict. He refused to go back to Italy once Mussolini came to power. And as we talked about earlier, he avoided Bayreuth and then Salzburg. And I'm not sure, but he might have gone a little overboard in one case. And I don't know a whole lot about it, but it strikes me that in the case of Kirsten Flagstad, the Norwegian soprano, I'm not sure that Toscanini did the right thing. The standard, the Tristan and Isolde of that period, include running into the 40s and the 50s, were Lauritz Melchior and Kirsten Flagstad, the Norwegian soprano. And when, after the Germans invaded Norway in 1940, Flagstad left the United States and went back to Norway. And for Toscanini, who left Italy once Mussolini came to power, this was not the right thing. And that might be a little overly judgmental. I think her family, her parents were in Norway, and she could just as easily have gone back just to make sure that her family was okay. But thereafter, after the war, when Toscanini performed Tristan and Isolde, he refused to take the outstanding pair, which was Melchior and Flagstad, and Helen Traubel, the American-born soprano, replace Kirsten Flagstad in all of Toscanini's Tristans, which, I guess the bottom line here is that you can have extremes, and those are easy, but then you get stuff that's kind of hazy and in the middle in terms of whether one did or did not do the right thing in terms of opposing Hitler. and doing everything possible to be disassociated from Hitler. So the judgments become a little cloudy, and Fort Wengler is probably one example, and Kirsten Flagstad is another. It's not black and white. Richard Strauss, I think, is different. I mean, you know, come on, getting up there.
Yes, he was born in 1864, and so by 1944, you know, he's already 80 years old.
And I think he died in 1945, didn't he, in Switzerland?
He died in 1949.
49.
And so Richard Strauss, I suppose, as we said earlier, I think he had some Jewish family members and also, however, had to make a living somehow. And whether this was, you know, just kind of settling back and composing more or less in a fairly sequestered situation, hard to say, but I have the impression that Richard Strauss was never considered, you know, a collaborator, certainly, and possibly not even really a sympathizer.
Well, yeah, but, you know, in terms of options, I mean, he certainly had the same option that Toscanini had. I mean, Toscanini wasn't Jewish, of course. He could leave and come to the United States. There's no question that if Strauss had wanted to come to the United States,
he
would have been allowed to come. But you're right. He was a much older man by then, and one has to make allowances for that.
And then there's the case of Herbert von Karajan, too, another, of course, non-Jewish conductor who was then, sort of an assistant conductor, just becoming prominent as a conductor in his own right. And if I remember the story correctly, von Karajan was conducting in the presence of Hitler, with Hitler in the audience, and he thought memorized the score and then lost his place and was on the outs with Hitler. But I think you said Frank von Karajan was a member of the Nazi Party.
That's right. I think he had joined the Nazi Party. And I think what the thing that von Karajan had going from after the war was his youth. I mean, we were sort of at opposite ends of Richard Strauss here. Strauss had his age as a mitigating factor, I think, in von Karajan's case. I mean, unlike Fort Wengler, he joined the Nazi Party. And I think he was even, as I recall from the Fort Wengler biography that I read, that von Karajan was basically trying to maneuver to lead the Berlin Philharmonic while Fort Wengler was, by sort of becoming, by making clear his identification with the Hitler regime. So he got the benefit of youth in the post-war period because he was recognized as one of the most.
Oh, yes, one of the most recorded conductors and on the Deutsche Grammophon label,
right.
Almost ubiquitous, Herbert von Karajan. And of course, the passage of time after a while seemed to be a factor. I mean, those who could live long enough to have their reputations balanced out by their later work.
Well, yeah, and I think, in a sense, the passage of time is sort of a theme which, in a sense, unifies the conversation we had a few weeks ago with respect to Holocaust trials, that after the war, the ardor for prosecuting persons involved in the Nazi regime sort of died out because of the Cold War. And so there's a certain parallel between that and what we're talking about today, so that Elizabeth Schwarzkopf was not, she was fine after a couple of years, and von Karajan was fine after a couple of years, and Fort Wengler was somewhat rehabilitated largely through the efforts of Yehudi Menuhin, and things kind of got smoothed over.
Were those decisions as to who performed what or who got to perform after the end of the war in 1945, were those decisions made by the four Allied powers in Germany?
Well, there was what we call a denazification program that was held in Germany, where persons were either cleared of or found to have participated in the regime. But the consequences of that, that was part of a rather zealous effort that followed the war immediately to try to deal very significantly with Nazism and with Nazis and with fascism. And the denazification program was a component of that. But as we've seen, the Cold War with pretty much preempted all of that, so that the focus was,
we don't care that much if you were a Nazi. We just care that you're not a communist.
That you're opposed to communism. And you know, one does have to remember that, you know, the Soviets occupied and basically took over Hungary, Romania, Czechoslovakia,
Poland,
a good chunk of Austria and East Germany. And also, and I remember this, I mean, the communist parties were not weak in Italy and France. I mean, they regularly got 30-35% of the vote. So that the idea of stemming the communist tide became a little bit more important than dealing with Nazis. And it affected many, many things, including the music world.
Do you have a sense of how long it took European music to recover, Frank? Because here you have, I mean, literally just Bronislaw Huberman alone responsible for bringing out, you know, 1,000 musicians out of Germany, 1,000 Jewish musicians. And you have then the orchestras are greatly reduced. But then by the time you have, at least for a couple of years, this denazification program, so that would exclude a lot of the ones who stayed behind. There couldn't have been too many left that didn't fall into one camp or the other.
Well, you, in general, in the rubble of post-war Europe, rebuilding orchestras was not a top priority. I mean, there's a lot of rebuilding that had to be done before you got to orchestras. And by the time you did get to orchestras, it was the Soviet threat that was the major concern, not Nazi past. So that, yes, the German orchestras did rebuild. I mean, the Berlin Philharmonic is obviously recognized as one of the outstanding orchestras in the world, the Staatskapelle, Dresden as well.
Probably and took, what, a good 10 years, though,
before they started. It took a good 10 years, but it took a while to rebuild Germany. I mean, it wasn't just the music scene. It was a bombed-out Germany. But yes, I think there's no question that German culture suffered. I mean, you can't take away the Steinbergs and the Bruno Walters and the Erich Leinsdorfs and the countless talented musicians and take them away and expect to have the same thing. So that in that ironic sense, the rest of the world was enriched by what happened, and it was Germany's loss. But I think that we're not talking about 80 years ago. I think time has kind of smoothed that over so that it's no longer a major deficit at all.
Frank Turkheimer, thanks for giving us some insight into what seems to have been a unique situation in the history of music, the Orchestra of Exiles.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.